Hi, everybody. Today, Thursday, May 22nd, 2025, and our friend, Professor Jeff Roberts, is back with us. Welcome back, Jeff.
Thanks for having me back, Nima. Good to see you again.
Jeff, let's get started with the phone call between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. What do you make of the phone call? The two arguments right now on the part of Russians, they don't consider any sort of ceasefire. While they're negotiating on the part of the United States, they're pushing for some sort of ceasefire and then the negotiations to be started or maybe continued. Your take on that?
Well, the significance of the phone call, of course, is that Trump seems to have accepted the Russian position. Putin's position is that there should be peace negotiations, but they shouldn't be predicated on having a ceasefire first. So a ceasefire will arise out of detailed peace negotiations, not the other way around. So Trump has called for immediate peace negotiation or continuation of peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. That's what he wants to see happen. And the Russians have responded saying that they're going to draw up a peace memorandum, which will set out in detail how they see the main outlines of a peace settlement. So, from one point of view, you could see it as a huge propaganda coup by Putin and the Russian side. Europeans, Ukrainians, of course, are aghast. That's what's happened because they were manoeuvring to get Trump lined up with them to put pressure on Putin to agree to an immediate ceasefire. And if Putin didn't agree to a ceasefire, then to impose more sanctions, to take more action against Russia. So their basic maneuver was to draw the United States, Trump administration back into a confrontation with Putin and Russia over the Ukraine war. And that maneuver has failed completely. Trump has refused to be drawn back into a confrontation. Not only that, what he's done is effectively said this, is that, that the United States is stepping away from the negotiations. It's up to the Russians and the Ukrainians to negotiate a settlement. Maybe at some point in the future, the United States can get involved to help broker some kind of final settlement. But my understanding is that the Americans are no longer directly involved in these peace talks. And neither are the Europeans, by the way. I suppose that's the other significant thing about what's happened is Trump has stepped back from it from the American part, but the Europeans are excluded from these negotiations as well. Though, of course, they'll be hovering around in the background.
But how, we know that Donald Trump talked with Europeans as well, same day that he talked with Vladimir Putin. What do we know about that? What were the main objectives of this sort of communication between the United States and Europeans?
What we know about that initially was what the Europeans said about the conversation. And they presented the conversation that they were going to take certain action, they were going to demand an immediate ceasefire. And if Putin didn't agree to the ceasefire, they were going to impose further sanctions. And the way they presented their conversation with Trump was that Trump was on board for this kind of ultimatum they were presenting to the Russians. But if you actually looked at it carefully, what their actual statement said, there was no direct statement that Trump agreed with what they were doing. What they said was, well, this is what we're going to do, and we had a conversation with Trump about this, implying that Trump agreed to what they said. But we very quickly found out, of course, that Trump didn't agree with what they were trying to do. So that was a piece of misdirection on their part. So Trump never had any intention of lining himself up with the Europeans and the Ukrainians against the Russian side. I mean, Trump keeps on saying that, you know, this is Biden's war. It's not his war. He wants peace. He wants to end the slaughter. He's not going to get drawn back into to the proxy war with Russia. I mean, basically, what he's doing, what they're doing, they seem to be doing anyway, is that they're running down the clock on the conflict as far as the United States involvement is concerned. The aid hasn't stopped. Presumably, they're still continuing to share their intelligence with the American intelligence with Ukrainians, but the aid, in due course of time, the material aid will more or less cease to exist, and that's all that's left will be the intelligence sharing that's going on, and even that might go down to a lower level as well. Now, the interesting thing though is this: I was thinking about this. Why has Trump done this at this particular time? What explains it? Okay, and one explanation is, of course, is that he tried to broker a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia. The Americans themselves came up with their own proposal, but neither the Russians nor the Ukrainians were willing to buy into it. And at the same time, you had the Europeans snapping on the sidelines, basically trying to sabotage American efforts to get some kind of deal between Ukraine and Russia. So that direct intervention by the United States into the peace process, such as it is, has failed. And Trump is frustrated. So that's one reason why he's decided to wash his hands of the whole thing. Step away. I don't think step completely away. Step back rather than step away, and allow let the Russians and the Ukrainians just to sort out themselves. But I think there's also another thing going on. I think Trump has an idea about what's going to be happening in the war in the next few months. And I have a suspicion that the Trump administration believes that in the next few months, Ukraine is going to suffer significant defeats, military defeats. And there's even a possibility that there might be a complete Ukrainian military collapse. Now, the closer that Ukraine comes to defeat, and in the event of a Ukrainian military collapse, the greater will be the pressure on the Trump administration to get involved in the war in some way, to save the situation in some form. So I think he's preparing for that eventuality, because the longer the Americans are semi detached from the process, the harder it's going to be for the warmongers to draw them back in. So I think the Americans know more than we do, because obviously they've got far better information about what's going on the battlefield, and what's likely to happen than I have or you have. Or external observers. So I think they're anticipating military defeat, and they're trying to distance themselves from that defeat and make sure that they can withstand the pressure to get back involved again. And also, I think what they want to achieve is this: they want, in terms of the blame game, obviously the Europeans are going to blame Trump and his administration for Ukraine's defeat, but the Americans, obviously, they're preparing to blame the Europeans, because they're going to say, well, you wanted to carry on the war, you took responsibility, okay, so you bear the consequences. Yeah, it's your problem, it's not our problem.
Do you understand why has Donald Trump not been able to convince Zelensky? Because when you look at Russia, they said that they're not going to talk with Zelensky and his administration because they don't recognize Zelensky as the official president of Ukraine, but they have changed their mind. And right now, at least they're talking to each other directly. What was the problem with the Trump administration that they couldn't convince Zelensky or maybe Europeans into a less... how can I put it, less suffering way for Ukraine to put an end to the conflict? What is the problem in your opinion?
Just to clarify, on negotiating with Zelensky, that issue on the Russian side, what the Russians' position is that, and this hasn't changed, is that they're prepared to negotiate with Zelensky or his representatives. What they're concerned about is that any agreement they signed with Zelensky or his representative might not be legally valid or constitutionally valid, because they don't think he's a constitutionally valid presidency. So the issue is not about negotiation process. It's about who finally or what finally signs off on the ultimate agreement. Now, in terms of why the American initiative failed, well, you mentioned one thing, right? Europeans. Yeah, I mean, you know, Europeans quite effectively helped sabotage Trump's efforts to broker a peace deal, because the Europeans, well, most of them, want to continue the war. I doubt that there's many European leaders who still believe in the possibility of Ukrainian victory or reversing Russia's territorial gains, but presumably they think it's possible that Ukraine can avert defeat, and they are hoping that they can bring the Americans back into the conflict, if not the Trump administration, then some future administration. Now, and I think that's all complete wishful thinking, has no reality, but that's their perspective. So the Europeans' negative role in the process, that I think that's one part of the answer. But also, but it's not fundamentally Europeans. The fundamental problems is that the Ukrainian side is not willing to make the necessary concessions and compromise to make a deal possible, particularly in relation to territory. Presumably because they share European fantasy about being able to keep the war going, yeah, to avert defeat. But also, of course, is that any move by the Zelensky regime towards any kind of peace deal with Russia, or whatever the terms actually, would create an enormous kind of like internal domestic political crisis in Ukraine, a split in the regime. The ultra nationalist element of the Zelensky alliance would turn against him. Zelensky going for a peace deal, it would probably mean the end of his presidency. So that, I think that's the other thing that's going on. It's Zelensky's political self-interest and what's going to happen in Ukrainian domestic politics in the event of any move towards some kind of deal with the Russians. Now, I do believe, or at least I hope, I think it's possible. I won't necessarily be too optimistic, but I think at some point Zelensky or another Ukrainian leader or another Ukrainian regime will get to the point where they're prepared to do a deal with Putin, and are prepared to face up to the negative political consequences of that within Ukraine. But they're only going to get to that point after some more military setbacks. Yeah, I mean, I think the unfortunate truth is that it's going to take a few more months of battlefield reverses, defeats, destruction, tens of thousands of deaths on the Ukraine or on the Ukrainian side, to actually get us to the point where you have the government in Kiev is willing to actually engage in serious peace negotiations with Russia and to negotiate on the Russian terms, because Russia is winning. The peace is going to be, I won't say dictated by Russia, not this stage anyway. But it's certainly going to be shaped by Russia. And, the key components of any peace treaty are going to be, in line with what the Russians want and what Russians have said that they want. I'm inclined to say this, actually, is that sooner Ukraine is defeated, the better it will be for Ukraine and for the Ukrainian people. So I hope, these military developments happen quite quickly. They may not. I mean, the grinding attritional struggle that we see at the moment could continue for a long, long long time today. But I hope it doesn't. I hope there is maybe not a Ukrainian military collapse, but Ukrainian military begins to teeter a bit, and the danger is there. So then that might concentrate the minds of Ukrainian politicians and also the minds of the Ukrainian army commanders as well, because you know ultimately only some kind of a Russian victory is going to end the war, right? And it's what kind of a Russian victory, how damaged Ukraine is going to be when we get to that point, and what it's going to be able to salvage in terms of some kind of a peace deal. And of course, once we get to that point, then of course the United States will be back in the picture big time, helping the Ukrainians to get the best deal that they can. And also hopefully by that time European leaders will have come to their senses and they will be of the same mindset. But that's what we need to get to the situation. Ukrainians are willing to do a deal, not because they like it, because they have to. And the Europeans and the Americans are cooperating together to get the best possible deal from the Russians. And of course, on the other side, the Russians being prepared to make some concessions as well. And I do believe that if that kind of scenario materializes, yeah, I think on the Russian side, they will be prepared to make some significant concessions.
Here is, Jeff, here is what Zaluzhny, and the former commander-in-chief of Ukrainian armed forces and the current ambassador to the United Kingdom, said. He said that he no longer believes Ukraine will recover its 1991 or 2022 borders. This shows how Zaluzhny perceives the current situation in Ukraine. When you look at the behavior of the European countries, the question is why did not decide to go to get along with the Trump administration? What was in their mind in terms of Ukraine? How could Ukraine overcome or somehow win the conflict in Ukraine? When you look at Europe today and European countries, especially in the United Kingdom, Germany, and France, who are running the show in Europe in terms of the conflict in Ukraine, what do they want from Ukraine?
Well, I mean, Zaluzhny's view is quite a widespread one, particularly in Ukraine. There's very, I would hazard a guess, there's very few people who believe there's any serious possibility of Ukraine regaining any territory in any kind of substantial. And I would expect European leaders to be of the same mind. Now, in terms of real question, what's the explanation then for what the Europeans are doing? Well, obviously they don't want to admit defeat. Yeah, they want to put off admitting for defeat for as long as possible, because it's obviously going to be a huge kind of like political blow to in terms of their own domestic politics, and also in terms of their international prestige. So they're not yet willing to face up to defeat and the political and psychological consequences there will be from defeat. But actually,
but the time is not on their side.
No, yeah. It's not. But what you have to understand is that, the only way the war can be ended now is by the Ukrainians accepting Russian terms. Yes, and Russian terms do include some more territorial losses. Yeah. Yes. In the Donbass and in relation to Zaporizhia and Kherson. And there's also other terms which Ukrainians consider to be onerous. So, it's not just a question of stopping the war now. You stop the war now, but in order to do that, you have to make further concessions. And the Ukrainians don't want to make those concessions, right? And Europeans don't want to make those concessions, because that will have the effect of magnifying the nature of the defeat, the NATO Western failure in Ukraine. If we have a situation whereby, you know, Russia not only gets to keep what it has now, but it actually expands its territory quite significantly, all the way up to the Dnieper, in terms of Kherson and beyond the Dnieper, in terms of Kherson and Zaporozhye. So, the Russian terms aren't acceptable. That's the answer to your question. But as you said, you know, time is not on their side. Time is on the Russian side, and you know, it's more or less inevitable at this stage that, at the very least, the Russians are going to make significantly more territorial gains, right, in the Donbass and in Kherson and Zaporozhye. Whether they'll be able to get all the way to the Dnieper and cross the Dnieper and, you know, recapture Kherson city and capture Dnieper, yeah, which is the capital of Zaporozhye, and captures Zaporozhye city, which is the capital of Zaporozhye. I think that those are kind of separate questions, but it is inevitable. The Russians are going to make significant more territorial gains. And I think that's got to happen before we get to the point that the Ukrainians will be willing to accept and engage with serious peace negotiations with Russia and make some serious concessions. And the Europeans are going to, you know, give up on their project of trying to continue the war for as long as possible.
With the current situation on the battlefield, do you think that Russia would go beyond the four oblasts that they're talking about? Are they going to go to, I don't know, Odessa, Nikolaev, going up to the Kharkov? Yeah, how do you see, or they're going to leave those four oblasts as a buffer zone for the future?
Just now, Putin has announced that the Russians are going to establish a buffer zone in the Kursk area, Belgorod and Bryansk. And by that, he means that they're going to, what the Russian military is going to occupy territory on the Ukrainian side of the border. So that's actually that's a specific kind of escalation of Russian current territorial demand. So of course, establishing a buffer zone, you know, is not the same as actually occupying the territory with a view to annexing it incorporating it. I don't think there's any intention of going beyond the four provinces that have already been incorporated into Russian Federation. That's the position, and there's been no wavering on that position. It's very slight Russian, you know, more hardline element among Russian public opinion have been lobbying and putting pressure on, you know, including on Putin himself, to get commitments to go further than the four provinces, you know, to go as far as Odessa, maybe Kiev, or to occupy Kharkov. But there's no sense that on Putin's part anyway, that he will expand the existing territorial demands, right? And if he did that would lead to all kinds of problems and complications, you know, not least with Russia's partners in the global south, you know, China, India, other countries who will be aghast if Putin decides to occupy more Ukrainian territory than he's already claimed so far. So I don't anticipate any expansion of Russian territorial demands. Of course, you know, circumstances might force Putin's hand on a Russian hand. You know, if there's a Ukrainian military and societal collapse, then all kinds of things might happen in terms of who gets to control what territory. But in terms of what we're talking about and this kind of like peace process, and the process has started, yeah. Okay, stuttering hasn't got very far, but it started. It hasn't stopped, and I think it will continue in some point. In terms of that peace process, The territorial issue is about Russian control of these four provinces, which they incorporated into the Russian Federation in October 2021. Now, I also happen to believe that Putin might be willing to make some compromises in relation to the complete incorporation of Zaporozhye and Kherson. I don't think he'll compromise on the Donbass, but he might be willing to concede to the Ukrainians continuing control of Kherson city and maybe continuing control of Zaporozhye. And of course, the thing you have to remember is that capturing Zaporozhye, the capital, and capturing Kherson city would be quite big military operations and potentially very, 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 very costly. So that, you know, by not going too far west, you know, there's significant benefits that the Russians can gain, and they could also gain. Putin, of course, can also gain credit by being willing to make some concessions and make some compromises. And it seems to me that the obvious compromise or concession that Putin can make is that he can give up the demand for complete control of all the territory of Zaporozhye, Kherson, and the Donbass, and that can be the concession he makes. Of course, as part of a much bigger peace package. So I certainly don't see that happening this year. If the war goes on, that's a different matter, and there's all kinds of possibilities.
You've mentioned that Donald Trump, the outcome of the phone call between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin was that Donald Trump, right after that, said they have to talk to each other. They have to find a solution for the problem that they're facing. I was wondering, what is the outcome of that? Don't you think that would complicate the situation? Or I don't see Zelensky being capable of making any sort of agreement, because his position is weakening in Ukraine as time goes by. He's not in a good position, and he's fighting for his position. He's fighting for his administration. How you can believe that someone like Zelensky, who in the eyes of Russian, who has no credibility in Ukraine, would make a deal with Russians?
It is very difficult to see that happening, and it may be that ultimately, for there to be an actual deal, Zelensky will have to be step aside, or be forced aside, or be replaced in some form. Who knows? But look, in terms of the peace, the process as it is, there's not going to be a deal, because the two sides are too far apart in terms of what they're prepared to agree on. And as you said, Zelensky is, and his regime is, dead set against any kind of compromise peace with Russia. But what the two sides can do, they can make their positions clear. They can clarify. So there's all kinds of details that can be dealt with, important details, actually, in the next few, and they started doing that. I mean, obviously they have agreed on this prisoner exchange, significant prisoner exchange. In relation to a ceasefire, there can be some exchange of views about how a ceasefire would operate. Should there be with one? There can be exchanges of views on the nature of Ukraine's neutrality or in relation to a possible international security guarantee for Ukraine. There's all kinds of details which are going to need to be agreed upon eventually, but there can be some progress, at least clarification as to what the situation is. So when we get to the point that the two sides, for different reasons, the Ukrainians because they've lost so much and they don't want to lose anymore, and the Russians because they've won enough for them to be prepared to end the war. Once we get to that position, then you can actually have quite a rapid negotiation of a final agreement. And we need to keep reminding ourselves is that 3 years ago in Istanbul, there was quite a substantial amount of agreement reached about a peace deal. Okay, there were lots of outstanding details in that negotiation. It wasn't a done deal by by many means, but it shows you what's possible if the two sides want to actually do a deal. Now, for a brief time in 3 years ago in Istanbul, it seemed that the two sides were prepared, did want to do a deal with each other and agree terms. And the result was, these draft agreements, which were initialed by the two sides. Yeah, so obviously there's going to be, even if Zelensky was in power or some other Ukrainian politician was in power, Poroshenko or Timoshenko, none of them are actually going to sign up to the kind of peace deal that the Russians want at the present time, for the same reason that Zelensky won. They don't want to do it. And also because it's at the moment anyway, it's politically impossible to actually do it. Yeah, but change the situation, the military situation, the more that reality dawns on the Ukrainians about the abyss they're staring into, and the same goes for the Europeans as well, the more the possibility is that we might get to a situation whereby there could be some actual agreements reached.
Jeff, recently Marco Rubio said that they want to withdraw from Ukraine somehow. They haven't decided so far what would that be, how is it going to be look like, but we know that they're just losing their interest in the conflict in Ukraine. And they said if the Europeans wants to send weapons to Ukraine, feel free to do that. They can buy from us and send it to Ukraine. But how, in your opinion, right now in Europe, do they really want it to be continued? How about the security architecture? How about the future of Europe? How about the future of energy? How about the future of what's going on and its impact on the bigger picture between the United States and China? The picture is much more complicated than what the Europeans are offering right now. It doesn't seem that they totally understand what's going on and why did the Trump administration decide to withdraw from Ukraine, because they're trying to pivot from Europe to...
But here's the thing, Nima, they don't see the world the way you see it. Yeah, they don't see the situation the same as you do it. A crucial thing is that from their point of view, Russia and Putin is the enemy, right? And that's why they've been conducting this. That's why they kind of were so keen on expanding NATO up to Russia's borders. That's why they've been conducting this proxy war against Russia in Ukraine, because they see Russia as being a fundamental enemy. And in a way, from their point of view, there's no alternative but to keep on fighting in Ukraine, because once the Ukraine war is over, the struggle continues, right, with Russia, and less favorable terms, less favorable terrain. So the really important thing is Russia as the enemy. Now the interesting thing about the Trump administration, including Rubio, is that they've redefined the United States view and relationship with Russia. Yeah, they no longer see it as an adversary, an enemy, a rival for sure. They started to look at Russia through a different lens, which is as a potential collaborator, right, an ally, yeah. And they've also begun to be able to see the Russian point of view. They've begun to understand, empathize with the Russians, and why Putin went to war. Why the Russians are insisting on why the Russians are refusing to end the war. Now they're refusing to have a ceasefire. Why they're insisting that they're not going to end the special military operation until they've achieved their fundamental strategic goals. The Americans now actually have begun to see it, but the Europeans still don't, right? And until they do, they're going to continue with this blinkered position that they have. But I suppose the other thing, of course, is that the price of their blinkered view, right, the misperceptions, right, misconceptions, is being paid by Ukraine. And Ukraine's just not okay. Yeah, there is some damage, economic damage, and there's political damage. Yeah, it's not a completely free pass. But you know, if the Europeans were having to make the same sacrifices as the Ukrainians have been making in this conflict, they might. I expect they would have a very different view of what's going on in Russia, and for sure, their citizens would have a different view. And I suppose the other thing is, you know, from the point of view of okay. There are different views among European politicians, right? You know, there are hardliners and there are softliners. From the hardline perspective, the problem they face is that if you have a deal with Putin, right? There's a negotiated agreement. The peace comes to an end. Compromise peace. Okay, even on the most kind of like onerous terms, right? If Putin gets everything he wants, everything is demanded, right? In terms of his, if he gets the whole lot, it will still be a compromise peace, right? An agreed peace, a negotiation, an outcome of diplomacy. And that completely undermines their hardline perspective, which is you can't do deals with Putin. He won't stop at Ukraine. He's an expansionist, imperialist. He's going to carry on. But if you actually have a peace deal and he signs up for it, and everyone can see that. What's the basis of their argument? So from the hard line point of view, they have to keep the war going for as long as possible, because as soon as it ends, and particularly if it ends in an agreed ending to it, yeah, an armistice, a deal of some kind, it's completely undermined their position. So from their point of view, it's best to keep on fighting, even if it like destroys the Ukrainian state, because if Ukraine goes down, oh, that's too bad. But the Russian bogey remains, doesn't it? The Russian spectre remains. The Russian enemy remains. And in fact, from a hardline point of view, you can even magnify the nature of the threat by pointing to what's happened to Ukraine. You know, Ukraine's been destroyed. So we'll be next. Now, the fact that Ukraine's been destroyed because of their politics, you know, their proxy war, yeah, not because of Russia, but there's also soft lines. There's people in a more pragmatic point of view, and hopefully their position is going to, who I think would genuinely would be prepared to sign up to a peace deal with Russia or for Ukraine to do so, providing well, obviously they have their own idea of what the terms should be, and at the moment their idea of what terms are not realistic. Yeah, what they want to see happen is not going to happen. But as I say, as the military situation develops, perhaps their minds will begin to change, and also perhaps their voices, the voices of more pragmatic, more realistic kind of faction among European political elite circles will gain more traction.
Jeff, how do you find the new Chancellor of Germany, Merz? It seems that they're playing with Taurus missiles again, we have not decided to send. How do you see the Russian part perceiving this sort of somehow playing with Russia with these Taurus missiles? Do you find that if they send these missiles to Ukraine, that would escalate the conflict?
Well, it wouldn't help, would it? But opinion seems to be that the Taurus missiles wouldn't make that much difference. Wouldn't make a definitive difference, a strategic difference. Yeah, that would cause problems for Russians. Kill more Russians. Obviously be a bit of a boost, but my understanding is, supplying these Taurus missiles is not on the agenda at the moment. That's my understanding. Now, of course, as things get more desperate in Ukraine, then perhaps it might come back on the agenda, but the problem there is the more desperate the Ukrainian situation gets from a military point of view, the less reason there is to actually supply this technology to them, because they're not going to be able to make a lot of use of it. And also, if your argument is that, in Ukraine, we're fighting this fundamental battle with the Russians, well, if the Ukrainians are losing, you want to keep your military hardware, don't you? You want to keep your tourist missiles for yourself, you know, for the future conflict, which is what you claim is what's going to happen. So I don't think there might be talk about the tourist missiles going, yeah, but I don't actually think that is going to happen. I mean, he's hamstrung by the fact that, you know, he's in coalition with the Social Democrats. His general political position in terms of support in Germany is, I think, constrains his political action as well. So yeah, it strikes me as just what's going on. It's just talk. It's just rhetoric. It's just performing. Giving a performance. So I don't take it too seriously in the end, is my answer to your question. And the same applies to the British, and the same applies to the French situation as well. The Russians, of course, are appalled. You know, I mean, the Russians have always said throughout this conflict that the Russians have always been more disappointed in the Europeans than they have in the Americans. The Americans, they expected the Americans to behave the way they did, particularly as they were dealing with the Biden administration. But they didn't expect the Europeans to kowtow.
Especially Germany. They're so disappointed with Germany.
And go against their own interests. I find it just difficult to understand myself. So they really have very, very negative attitudes towards the current crop of European political leaders. They're trying to sideline them as much as they can, but they're perfectly happy to deal with the Americans, right? And obviously they're very happy to be dealing with, you know, a new president and a new administration, which has a fundamentally different view of the war than their predecessors.
Jeff, to wrap up this session, do you think that a new election, a presidential election in Ukraine, would help the process of negotiations, would somehow legitimize the people who are talking with Russians, who are negotiating with Russians, who are talking with Europeans, even with the United States? How is that going to influence the process of a Ukrainian settlement in the near future if they go in that direction?
But there's no sign that they're going in that direction at the moment, is there, as far as I can see? And it depends on what happens, isn't it? You know, who gets to stand and who wins. There seems to be this assumption that Zelensky would lose any election, right? Well, I'm not sure that's true. That may be the case. It may not, because Zelensky and his people have got such a grip on Ukrainian politics and society. You know, they might be able to win in an election. And also, you know, election is going to take, you know, weeks, months to organise and conduct, right? It's not something that's going to happen overnight. And I have to say, I think in the next few months, things are going to take such a decisive turn that any in the Ukraine election is going to be a purely secondary factor. I think it's much more likely there'll be some kind of internal coup in Ukraine rather than some kind of electoral process take place. But we'll have to wait and see what happens.
And do you think that would be due to this sort of coup that you're expecting, you're talking about, that would be because of the United States and the aid, the weapons and everything that coming from the United States, just reducing drastically?
Obviously, it will be a result of, you know, the desperate situation that Ukraine is going to find itself in the next weeks and months. And when I say it could be a coup, there's all kinds of different kinds of coups. It could be more than one coup. I don't see the Americans trying to engineer anything. I think when they say they're stepping away, I think they really mean it. I don't think the Europeans are up for that either. So it's all about the internal dynamics of Ukrainian politics. And I say there might be a coup, but I think that's unlikely because, you know, a coup would be divisive. It would split. You know, if the country's heading towards defeat, if you have an internal coup, which is disruptive and divisive and yeah, whatever, maybe even some kind of internal civil war. That's not going to do much for your military situation. So I think that will be a factor against it. So I think I probably might want a prediction for me. I don't think there will be a presidential election. I don't think there will be a coup either. I think, Ukraine will soldier on for as long as it can. But at some point, the regime, maybe even Zelensky, well, less likely, will actually have to come to terms with the Russia in order to end the war and in order to save Ukraine, to save their countries, to save their society from complete destruction. But they haven't reached a point where they think that that's the fundamental issue facing them. They don't see that the war has been at the moment has been existential for the Ukraine's sake. When they get to the point where they do see the continuation of the war threatening the very existence of Ukraine, I think that hopefully that will prompt them, to make the necessary overtures to the Russians and to arrive at some kind of peace deal.
Thank you.
I always like to end on an optimistic note, as you know. But as you also know, my optimism has frequently been confounded by events. But anyway, we'll see.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for being with us today.
Thanks.
Great pleasure, as always. Take care.
See you again. Bye.
See you again. Bye-bye.